It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we're looking back at some of our favorite interviews with NPR hosts over the past year. In November, NPR Morning Edition host and former Moscow bureau chief David Green came to Pittsburgh for a member event co-sponsored by 90.5 WESA and the World Affairs Council titled Reflections on Russia. Many of those reflections were included in his new book, Midnight in Siberia, about a train journey into the heart of Russia. He joined us by phone from Washington to talk about what inspired his book.
So I actually have now done two train trips across the Trans-Siberian, which is pretty insane in some people's minds. The first was at the end of 2011. I was wrapping up my time as Moscow correspondent for NPR, and I had always dreamt of doing this trip, and it also just felt like a way to try and just capture a snapshot of the country, not come to any conclusions, but sort of listen to voices and learn whatever I could from people, you know, about their lives and the nuance in Russia. And, you know, the Trans-Siberian just seemed like a great way to do it. It's sort of the spine of the country. I mean, this country is vast. It's just disparate villages and cities all the way to the Pacific coast. And, you know, the train line kind of holds it together in a way. So I had so much fun doing it the first time in 2011. I decided why not go back again last year and do a book about it. Go, you know, not as a radio journalist, but as a writer. And it was such a privilege to meet all these people and sort of be brought into their lives.
Now, this is no small undertaking. We're talking about a 6,000-mile journey from Moscow to the Pacific port of Vladivostok. Talk about just the arduous nature of a trip like this.
Well, it depends how you break it up. I mean, a lot of the time we would go from city to city and just do maybe 11 or 12 or 13 hours on the train. We did one leg, I think, on one of my trips that was about 47 hours. And you start to get a little claustrophobic. Like every time the train stops, you want to jump out on the platform and at least talk to other humans who are not on your train and, you know, buy some fish or some potato chips or something like that. But it's a real community. And this last trip, we went third class, and it's sort of this open dormitory, just, you know, dozens of bunks in a room. And so you're on top of each other, and, you know, you almost have to climb on someone's face to get up to an upper bunk if that's where you are. And you just sort of get this routine going. Sometimes you go to the dining car and, you know, spend a night drinking vodka or tea and meeting people, or you exchange food with other travelers who are sitting near you. You talk, you read a book, and you just kind of watch Russia pass by outside. It's never that boring, I will say. I mean, Russians are anything not boring. And, you know, they can be loud, noisy, enthusiastic. There's always something happening on the train. The people watching is better than any place I could possibly imagine.
And I want to get back into how train travel there is so very different from what we might experience here in the United States. But the point of this was to speak with ordinary Russians about how their lives have changed in the post-Soviet years. What were the people that you encountered telling you about that?
You know, a lot of people who are in their 40s, I would say 50s, 60s, feel very, very tired. They feel like they have lived through so much upheaval, you know, lived in different countries, as it were. You know, the Soviet Union, then Russia during perestroika, and now sort of Putin's Russia. And it's just been so much change. They feel really tired, and that, in some cases, can lead to this sense of dread when it comes to the idea of some sort of revolution. And so, you know, you talk to a lot of people who are not, they're not screaming and yelling that they love Vladimir Putin, but they kind of want things to be stable for as long as possible. And then that made me want to talk to the younger generation kind of about what they see as the future of their country. And there are some who kind of talk about democratic change and wanting a more Western-style system, but not everyone, far from everyone. You know, I met one young man, 21, in a village, you know, didn't have much money, lost both his parents when he was a teenager, had recently completed his mandatory year of military service, and said it made him into a Russian. And he just took so much pride in being tough and having faced hardship, and he was just happy to be in his community and sort of live the way life has been going. And then I talked to, you know, a guy in his 30s in the city of Novosibirsk who had a lot of money, has traveled all around the world, was educated in Minnesota, speaks perfect English, works at a carpet company that his family runs. And I said, you know, you've seen the world. I mean, is Vladimir Putin really the leader you want? And he said yes and no. And he said he knows that elections in Russia can be rigged. But he said so far the rigging to him has been unpleasant. It hasn't been so blatant to cause him to want to take to the streets. And so that just gives you a window that the winds of change are not blowing with that much force at the moment, it seems.
Does some of that, David, have to do with the idea that, immediately in the early part of the post-Soviet era in Russia, that things were kind of falling apart in some ways? Does it go back to that stability that you talked about, that people are feeling like, you know, we tried to westernize and it didn't really work, and we're not sure what we want to do now?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of people still talk of the Yeltsin years as this democratic experiment where, you know, Russians really suffered a lot economically. And there's no doubt, you know, for all of Russia's economic problems today and a lot of questions about the currency, a lot of questions about whether oil prices will get low and really damage the Russian economy in a terrible way, you know, if you look at Vladimir Putin's time in office and in power, in totality, you know, people in general are doing better than they were doing in, say, the Yeltsin years. And so Putin gets some credit for that. There are major problems. I mean, life expectancy for men is low. There's rampant alcoholism. There's rampant domestic violence. You know, it's just terrible. There's, you know, this inequality. But, you know, compared to something like the Yeltsin years, there's still a feeling of, a tough authoritarian leader does bring certain things to make our lives feel more orderly.
I wanted to get back to this train trip, this 6,000-mile journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway. And in the United States, when you travel on a train, I mean, you're drinking soda pop and you know, some you know, microwave sandwiches. I'm guessing that just the food culture on the train is so vastly different and interesting. Describe, you know, what you're sustaining yourself on as you make this 6,000-mile journey.
Well, it's funny. You mentioned the microwave food on Amtrak. That part is not always all that different. There's this samovar, which is, this old sort of big teapot that is very traditional Russian, and there's a modern-day one at the end of each train car, and it just always has hot water. And so you go there to make tea. You buy instant noodles. At any stop that you make on the train, you can make instant noodles during the day. You buy pastries and have it with your tea. You might go to the dining car, have some borscht or see what else they have. They often don't have nearly everything that they suggest they have on the menu. A menu is just sort of hypothetical in Russia, I feel like. But there's a lot of food sharing, too, and I learned that very quickly how important that is. I remember my first train trip, the woman in the cabin next door to me, you know, waved me in, saw I was an American, and used this big this Belarusian sausage link that she was holding to wave me into her cabin, gave me sausage homemade by her family, gave me this horseradish concoction homemade by her family, and I sort of wanted to give her something in return. All I had was a Luna bar from the plane that I've been packing up, which was really, really disappointing to her, and it made me feel totally humiliated. So in the future, in train trips, I would make sure to go to some deli or some store every stop I made and at least have something to offer other people, you know, if I sat down with them and the food sharing got going.
David, I wanted to, before we wrap this up, talk about a piece that you did recently where you visited with a farmer in Crimea who is having to make this transition from being a Ukrainian to a now Russian citizen. And his struggle with this decision really it speaks to the heart of this issue. Talk about this man and his story.
Yeah, so he is Crimean Tatar, and the Tatars are a Muslim minority in Crimea, and they have a really painful past. Stalin deported them from Crimea in World War II and stuffed them in boxcars and sent them to Central Asia. Many of them died on that trip. A lot of Tatar families fought to come back to their homeland, to come back to Crimea, and they finally did in the 1980s. They lived in Crimea as Ukraine for the past two decades and felt, you know, a sense of kinship with, you know, the West. Now Russia has taken over Crimea, and there have been young Tatar men who have been kidnapped, Tatar leaders who have been deported, and so it's sort of a nightmare for this community. But also, Crimeans under pressure to get Russian citizenship because it's much easier to do things like register a car, get government benefits. And so this young man, you know, he went to the office where you have to change your citizenship to Russian, and he just couldn't do it. He walked out. He still thinks he's going to need to, but he also has this infant son who he was so hoping would get a Ukrainian birth certificate and not a Russian birth certificate. He made it just at the last minute before they started printing Russian ones at hospitals. So his little baby is officially a Ukrainian citizen, and he just said, you know, that's a symbol of his hope that maybe, you know, Crimea will be one day Ukraine again. But I got to tell you, Paul, there's very little evidence of that, even though the West says that, you know, they believe the Crimea is still part of Ukraine. Everything is in rubles. Russian flags are flying everywhere. You know, Russia has established borders with Ukraine. Russia has literally taken a patch of Europe and made it its own in 2014. You know, it sounds like something out of the Empire days, but it's happened.
That was NPR Morning Edition host and former Moscow bureau chief David Greene back in November. Coming up, NPR host and producer Michelle Norris talks about eavesdropping on America's conversation on race. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.